Well, good afternoon and welcome to the last session of the day. We have only two talks scheduled for this final session. Both speakers have told me that they are going to forego their opportunity to take extra time, so I think we might finish a little bit on the early side. And after they're done, Bob Edmonds will have some closing comments. Our first speaker in the final session is Joel Baker from the University of Washington, Tacoma, and he will speak to us on the known unknowns, emerging chemical contaminants in the Puget Sound and beyond. Joel?
Thank you very much. Well, the sun is out. I'm very impressed that you all have hung on all day, and it's a real pleasure to be here. Thanks to Bob and the Water Center for organizing this really important meeting, and it is nice to get together once in a while and reflect on what we know about things. I'm going to spend some time today talking about, in a very sort of general sense, the evolution of our understanding of chemical contaminants in surface waters. I'm going to take a bit of a different tact to it, and we'll get to the kind of the recurring theme here as we move along. So the title is The Known Unknowns, and in the spirit of bipartisanship, which is now sweeping the country, or was sweeping the country for a few minutes, I never thought I'd be standing up here quoting Don Rumsfeld, but he actually said something once that was, when you first listened to it, you thought the guy's not very articulate. But then when you started thinking about it, it was one of the brighter things he said. I'm sorry, I shouldn't be. He's no longer anonymous. You know, the quote here is, there are known knowns, these are the things that we know that we know. There are known unknowns, that is to say, there are things that we know we don't know. And then there are also unknown unknowns, these are the things we don't know that we don't know. And the brilliance of this is the second point, is there are things out there in terms of water quality management that we know we don't know, but we know about them, right? And that's the focus of the talk today. The things I've been reflecting on over the last year or so since I've moved to the University of Washington is, how do we move off of studying the things that we already know more and more? As one of the reviewers of one of my proposals once famously said, this proposal is about less and less. How do we get out of that box? So I'm going to give you two examples of some work that my group has been engaged in over the last several years. And begin by talking about a recently known known, that is brominated flame retardants in the environment, and provide you some data from those family of studies as a way of talking about some newer classes of chemicals, certainly not new to the environment, but new to our understanding. And then I'll finish with what is something that's very new to me within the last 6 months or so, and ask the question, are physical pollutants on the horizon, and talk a little bit about some of the work we've been doing recently on microplastics in the marine system. So my research interests overall are focused on chemicals in the environment, chemicals that have anthropogenic sources, and for us to be interested in them, they have to be sufficiently persistent and mobile to be transported regionally and globally. So these are known by a variety of different names, persistent organic pollutants, POPs, other such acronyms. These chemicals tend to bioaccumulate in organisms, so that we work closely with biologists to understand how food webs work, so we can understand how the chemicals get into the higher trophic levels. That's important not only for impacts potentially on the food webs, but also in terms of impacts on those of us who like to eat fish and shellfish. And most of these chemicals, at one level or another, are human toxicants. The issue at hand for today's talk is really this conundrum that we find ourselves in, where much of the regulatory activities and water quality on the chemical contaminant side is driven by the U.S. EPA priority pollutant list. This is a list of chemicals, 180-some-odd chemicals, not even really chemicals. Some of the single line items in the priority pollutant list are things like coal byproducts and other classes of chemicals. But the priority pollutant list was put together, anyone know? I forget. Mid-70s, late 70s, early 80s kind of time frame. And at the time, it was the list of what was thought to be the major dominant chemical contaminants in surface waters that would drive risk in the U.S. That list has been very slow to be updated. And still, a lot of the work that is done in this country is derived around a list of chemicals that was created 30 years ago. As you might imagine, the chemical manufacturing industry hasn't stood still. There's lots of new things on the environment, and we need to think about that. There's been a number of international screening tools developed, I should say screening tools developed internationally, that tried to get beyond thinking about a reduced list of priority pollutants. The best of those, or the most recent of those, has come out in the last few months. It's a joint effort between Derek Muir at Environment Canada and Phil Howard at Syracuse Research Corporation, where they've screened all chemicals in commerce, screened them for not only the volume of the chemical that's being produced, but their potential toxicity, their persistence in the environment, all the things that might make them important environmental contaminants. And they come up with a list of on the order of 700 or 800 new chemicals or chemicals not on the priority pollutant list that may be of concern in the environment. So it's fair to say that there's lots of things out there. There's lots of unknowns that we know about from the Muir-Howard list of 800 plus. And the risk assessment is limited by the lack of information on these new materials. So let me start and tell you a little bit about something that we once called an emerging contaminant, but we've been having an emerging contaminant workshops for about 10 years on this topic, so they're not really emerging anymore. And that's the story of the brominated flame retardants. So as an environmental chemist, we're interested in understanding how the ecosystems respond to changes in inputs. And what's shown here is DDT, one of the classic persistent organic pollutants. And these are concentrations of DDT in nanograms per gram lipid in breast milk from Swedish women collected as part of the monitoring program in Sweden. And this runs from 1965 to 1995. DDT, the insecticide, was banned from production in Europe. The use really scaled back in the 70s. And you can see quite nicely when you stop putting something into the environment, it stops showing up in the environment. That works quite well. However, not everything is a good story like that. The blue line are the concentrations of a chemical that I'm going to talk more about in a moment, but these are brominated flame retardants, same samples. These are archived human milk samples in Sweden, and you can see that in the 1970s there was very little of it, none of this chemical, but its concentration increased dramatically in the human samples in the time period 1980 to 1995 kind of time frame. Really quite an alarming increase. So what are these blue dots? These are polybrominated diphenyl ethers. These are chemicals that are purposely produced and put into consumer products to prevent them from catching on fire, to make a long story short. These are flame retardant chemicals. In essence, it's the diphenyl ether structure with a bunch of bromines hung on it. And the way these things work chemically is if you have this computer, is the plastic is probably impregnated with something, either these chemicals or something like it. If it overheats and gets hot, these chemicals heat up and the bromines fall off and scavenge the free radicals out of the flame. So this thing will smoke all day, but it'll never flame, never catch on fire. And this is a fire protection product. So these chemicals were produced and put into commercial products because it was required by law that computer equipment, televisions, couches, curtains, carpets, all meet flammability standards, right? I mean, when you buy commercial products now, they have to pass certain flammability limits. So these are put in for a good reason. And they're halogenated aromatic compounds, which we know from lots of other work are generally persistent in the environment. So in this case, the details here are not so important, but most of what was produced and was shown in that last graph is something, a commercial mixture called penta-bromodiphenyl ether. And this was used in polyurethane foam in seat cushions and things of that nature. There are other flavors of this, other commercial product mixtures that are made, and I'll say more about those in a minute. But the point is that there's different the different property or different compounds have different properties for different reasons. That's one class of brominated flame retardants. There's lots and lots of different types of brominated flame retardants. So here's our brominated diphenyl ethers. But there's a whole bunch of others. You can't read the details here. But in essence, what they're doing is hanging bromines on organic structures. It's the bromine that can come off that's important. So anything you can hang a bromine on that's stable At low temperatures, but degrades at high temperatures, works as a flame retardant. I'm simplifying a little bit. So once that Swedish breast milk study came out and people began to look for brominated flame retardants in the environment, we found them in lots of different places. These are data from the Great Lakes. These are herring gall eggs in the Great Lakes from 1980 to the year 2000. Again, exponential increases of these compounds in the environment. Here's a Columbia River whitefish, something a little closer to home, only three data points here, but you see a large, rapid increase. These chemicals were really brought into the marketplace in the 1980s, 1990 kind of time frame. So once these graphs began to be presented at meetings, people went, oh, we have a problem here. So in the European Union underwent a voluntary, there was a risk assessment done, and this penta mixture was phased out of production and use in the European Union, and then there's a voluntary reduction of it in the U.S. So in response to these increases, things went away quite nicely. Oh, a little bit more environmental data, nice picture of seals. This is San Francisco. The seals in San Francisco Harbor are loaded with this stuff. Think Silicon Valley and production of all the electronics in San Francisco. Log scale here, rapid increase in the seals. The seals aren't kind of catching fire in San Francisco. More data. So they found them in humans. The interesting thing is that if you look at the amount of these chemicals of the polybrominated diphenyl ethers in Europe, Europeans versus Americans, there's about a 10 to 100-fold higher concentration in North Americans than there is in Europeans because we use 10 to 100 times more of this product in our products. So that slide didn't turn out too well, and I don't want to say too much about this, but there's lots of evidence now that these chemicals are causing sublethal effects in humans and in other mammalian systems. That's what happens when a Mac, right? I'm a chemist, and I can't even figure out what some of these structures are, so we'll skip that. So one of the things that happened here is that when they switched, this penta mixture was banned in Europe and was phased out in the U.S., but we didn't relax the flammability standard, right? We still needed to make sure that the stuff didn't catch on fire, so the industries did what they needed to do, which is to switch to other chemicals. And one of the first things they did was they switched from the penta lots of the things, but one of the things that became in production is this deca-bromo-diphenyl ether. And here's the structure. Bromines at all 10 positions, so 10 bromines per molecule as one of the alternatives. And at the time, not surprisingly, when you started to use it, if you went to a sediment, this is data from Ron Heitz's lab at Indiana University. So if you went after this stuff was produced and you looked at the different types of these flame retardants in a sediment sample, so this is lake sediment, most of the material is this deca-bromo-diphenyl ether. There's lots of it in the mud in the sediment. But if you look at the fish from the lake, there's no bar. There's no data. I mean, there's data, but they couldn't find it. So this chemical is in the mud, but not in the fish. And the argument was this molecule is too big, too hydrophobic, too large to be taken up by the organisms. Okay. So when these types of data came out, the regulatory agency in the U.S. And the people manufacturing said, oh, look, there's no risk, right? It's in the environment, but it's not being taken up by the fish. It's not being ingested by humans. No big deal. Don't worry so much about it. Which may be true, but there's a side note here. And this is, I'm going to go back and show you some original data from an original study that was done in Sweden. This is done in my lab at the University of Maryland, but it sort of replicated some work that was done in Sweden. What we did is we spiked this chemical into fish food and fed it to a fish, make a long story short. And these are chromatograms, if you're not thinking chemistry-wise. So this is retention time, and this is a single chemical. Each peak here is a different chemical. After 10 days, after 60 days, we never found this chemical accumulating in fish. These are carp. Okay, so no risk, right? No accumulation, no risk. But you notice that all this other stuff started appearing. Oh, that's odd. It wasn't in the food. It's not in the control fish, a little bit, but not very much. What we think is happening is this BDE-209, this deca-bromo-diphenyl ether, once it gets into the organism, is being debrominated, is being converted into the lower brominated congeners, and that indeed is what you're seeing here. So this looks like that old penta mixture that is no longer being produced, the fish is producing it from this other product. So a bit of a curveball there for us. And the way I view this is, so when you're doing a risk assessment on this compound, how do you do this? And the answer is, I think the analogy here is to DDT. Again, going back to our DDT example, as a pesticide, everyone thinks that DDT is very persistent in the environment and bioaccumulates. Not true. DDT actually breaks down fairly quickly in the environment. The bad news is it breaks down to DDE, which is extremely persistent in the environment, accumulates, and causes mortality to birds and other things. So really what we're doing in this case is we're releasing something into the environment that has probably very low bioavailability, but it's over time slowly being degraded into a chemical or a whole bunch of products that are exerting a risk on the population. So that's the brominated diphenyl ether story, and the message there is that there's unintended effects of releasing certain things in the environment that we don't necessarily anticipate up front, but we see only later. And the second message is as we ban individual chemicals one at a time, the marketplace shifts to other things that we don't understand nearly as well, oftentimes, as the things that we're banning. And here's another example. So, as I mentioned, there's a whole bunch of brominated flame retardants on the market now. This is from a paper from Heather Stapleton, who was my PhD student, who's now at Duke. And in particular, these two in the box are brominated phthalate. This one's a brominated phthalate. They're finding this now is in the highest concentrations in places like San Francisco Bay and elsewhere. These two compounds are the main ingredient of something called Firemaster 500, which is one of the main flame retardant compounds. These were first identified in the environment within the last 6 months. So there's no monitoring of this at all, other than that. So the flame retardant story is a real example of a moving target. And it makes it difficult to study because there's no requirement that the production information is released or that the properties or structures of the chemicals are provided. So we can't measure things if we don't know what they are. So let me shift gears a little bit and one final point, and I'll close, and that is this idea of, we think about chemical pollutants. I've spent my entire career measuring chemicals in the environment. But now we're faced with something that, they're chemicals, but they're plastics. What about microplastics? A colleague of mine at NOAA in a marine debris program called me about a year ago and said, do you know anything about microplastics in the environment? And I said, no, let's have a workshop. That's what academics do. You have a workshop. And it turns out there's only about 30 people in the world who have ever really thought about microplastics, not including this guy, right? Anyone old enough to recognize this is Dustin Hoffman, circa 1969, right? Pondering his career and his advice was, and the advice given to him was, plastics, right? So my advice to graduate students, plastics. We all know that in certain places in the world, there's aggregations of large floating debris, plastic debris in marine systems. That didn't turn out at all. It turns out if you look carefully under a microscope, you find a lot of really small bits of plastic in the ocean as well, in beaches and in coastal sediments and indeed floating in the sea surface microlayer. So why do we think that this is important? Well, we think it's important because plastic is incredibly persistent in the marine environment. Tony Andrade has done a lot of work on looking at rates of decomposition or degradation of plastic once it's in the marine environment. His conclusion from all of that work is basically all the plastic that's entered the ocean over time is still in the ocean. There really is no net sink for plastic in the ocean other than burial in the deep sediments. And this is the world plastic production from 1900 to 1950. Let's see, the graduate was right there. Yeah, right on the inflection point. So we're making lots of plastic, okay, and a lot of it is ending up in the ocean. And so we had a workshop in Tacoma last September. We brought people from around the world together to think about what the sources and implications of microplastics in the oceans are. When we started the workshop, the thought was that really, where's this stuff coming from? It's coming from big pieces of plastic. Your beer cooler falls off your fishing boat. it's happened. And it floats around, and eventually over time it breaks down, and you kind of generate little pieces of plastic. And this is certainly an important and probably the dominant way that microplastics get into the oceans. But we've come to find that there is also deliberate production and use of microplastics In my toothpaste, it turns out, there is, if you look at the ingredients in your cosmetics, if you use things like skin conditioners, abrasives, look on the ingredients, it'll say polyethylene. Crest toothpaste has polyethylene in it now. We don't know much about how important that is, but we're pretty sure that once it gets out in the environment, it's not going to go anywhere. So, and we know, so small particles, right? What do you know about small particles in the ocean? We know that zooplankton eat small particles in the ocean. Here's a quick snapshot, from Tony Andrade's work. They fed plastic particles to zooplankton. Zooplankton apparently aren't all that discriminating of palates. And they, in fact, ate the microplastics. Here's a shot in their gut. And then in the fecal pellets, they came out the other end. So there is an ingestion of microplastics by marine organisms. Now, these were highly contrived studies. They only had plastic to eat in very high concentrations. But just to demonstrate that they could in fact, it's like my house some nights, you know, nothing to eat. But it showed that they would, in fact, ingest these things. So the questions are really, and this is brand new emerging stuff here. We don't know where the stuff is coming from. We don't know if these microplastics, at the level they're present in the environment, or if they're messing up the aquatic communities or not, whether the zooplankton or other filter-feeding organisms are being impacted. We don't know whether microplastics out there are important geochemical phases. In other words, do they adsorb nutrients, or do they adsorb other things that are important to functioning ecosystems? And we don't really know if these microplastics, when you put them into the aquatic food web, they adsorb a lot of other pollutants. So is this a route of exposure to the aquatic food web of other chemicals adsorbed onto the plastic? Or flipping it around, when you put plastic in the ocean, it leaches out the component chemicals, such as flame retardants. So we don't know on a global level where they're leaching a microplastics as an important source of chemicals to the ocean. So there's a lot of questions about this. Here's the people who are going to give you the answer. This is the workshop we held in Tacoma last fall. These are the participants. If you're interested in this more, go to the NOAA Marine Debris Program website. The proceedings from this conference just came out last week, and they're available for you on the website. And I'd be glad to talk to you more about that. So I will stop there. But just to say, if you haven't heard of the Center for Urban Waters, it's a new initiative in the city of Tacoma. We break ground on the 17th of April on a brand new three-story lab building right on the Theophos Waterway. It's a partnership between the Puget Sound Partnership, the city, and the university. So we encourage you all to learn more about the Center for Urban Waters. I'd be glad to talk to you more about that. So thank you for your time, and I'll take questions if there are any. Yes. Yeah, so the question is what types of sublethal toxicity do you see with the flame retardants? There's a wide variety of effects because there's a wide variety of the chemicals, so I can't really generalize it. The brominated diphenyl ethers that most of the work has been done on, they're thought to be mimics of the thyroid system. The slide that didn't turn out was meant to show you that. The thyroid system is based on iodine. These are based on bromine, but there's a similar structure between the two. And the diphenyl ethers interfere with the production and circulation of thyrex in the bloodstream. So that's one example of effects. It's also been linked to low birth weights and in a variety of other sublethal endpoints on both most of the work's been done on mammals. There's a little bit done on fish.
Do we have any microplastics in Puget Sound?
Do we have any microplastics in Puget Sound? Yes, it turns out we do. There is a group that I've just found out about, a local citizen group based in over on the Olympic Peninsula, and they've been going around and sampling microplastics in beaches all around Puget Sound. They have this fabulous data set. And I just met them at the Georgia Basin Conference last week. We are currently developing the methodology. One of the problems with microplastics is that there's no standard methods for measuring it. So, and at the workshop, so we had people coming from Australia and the UK, and they had different answers, and it wasn't clear whether that was because they're using different methodologies. So we're working to standardize the methodologies. Right now the methods are really tedious. It's basically doing it's graduate student intensive. You sort through the samples and pick out the plastic by hand. So we're hoping for better techniques. But I suspect there are, any urbanized area will have lots of microplastics. Yes. Here first.
You mentioned the water pool falling off and breaking down the microplastics. How small do these things eventually come? Is there sort of a break point where they don't get any smaller?
Yeah, we think so. So the question is how, as large pieces of plastic break up into microplastics in the environment, is there a break point where they no longer fall apart? We, at the workshop, define microplastics as things less than 5 millimeters, which doesn't sound like microns to me, but less than 5 millimeters. And the reason for that is that these are particles small enough that don't cause blockage of GI tracts. You know, the big plastic stuff is concerned to the bird biologists and fisheries biologists because it physically disrupts blocks the GI tract. So less than five millimeters. The physics suggests that once they get down to probably a few hundred microns, that there's no longer any abrasive forces like on the beaches and things, but they're moving with the fluid flow. So I suspect that there's an accumulation mode there, and there's no further degradation from that. But we don't know that for sure. One more, and then, please.
How can the bromated flame retardants primarily get into the environment?
Yeah, a really good question. So how do the brominated flame retardants get into the environment? Let's see. So here's the evidence. The evidence is the concentrations are higher indoors than outdoors. And the concentrations are higher in children than they are in adults. So when the brominated flame retardant data first came out, the immediate paradigm we fell into was the paradigm of dioxins, thinking it was an environmental exposure, it was eating fish and meat and dairy products and kind of all that diet sources. But as the observations came out that I just referred to, it becomes more obvious that the main route of exposure for at least those types of flame retardants is dust in the household or emission from things in the household. So the car dealers in the audience, that new car smell, that's flame retardants. The hot smell when you buy a new one of these and you fire it up, that smell, that's flame retardant. The dust in your house is really high. And the reason that kids have a lot of it is because they eat a lot of dirt in the household. Thank you.